Potential, Not Pathology, embracing creative and resourceful approaches to psychotherapy with author and therapist, Dr. Paul J. Leslie.
Welcome to Potential, Not Pathology, where we offer information and inspiration for mental health therapists who are interested in learning and applying unique therapeutic techniques and concepts in their work. With a focus on the potential each client brings to his or her therapy session, this program examines ideas and tools which can assist your clients on their journey toward healing. I'm Paul J. Leslie. I'm glad you're here. Today we're going to be having an interview with the lovely Dr. Rachel Hott. Rachel's been a friend of mine for a little while. She's a clinical psychologist. She has a PhD in clinical psychology. She's a master trainer in neuro-linguistic programming and the co-director and co-founder of the NLP Center of New York. She's exceptionally good at what she does. She's been trained by all the leading proponents of neuro-linguistic programming, as well as Ericksonian hypnosis. And she's been a course leader for the American Management Association and a private consultant for executives. She's even been trained by Jack Canfield, who a lot of people know from Chicken Soup for the Soul, The Success Principles, other books he's written. Worked with Jack to facilitate self-esteem trainings. And her specialization areas include performance anxiety, sexual issues, life transitions, addictions, weight control, and sleep and exercise. In addition to NLP, she's also trained in eye movement desensitization and reprocessing and self-relation psychotherapy, as well as core transformations. In our interview, she gives us a little background about how she came to learn NLP. And for those who might not know what NLP is, she gives us a little information about how this style of therapy, these tools can work and assist clients with a wide variety of presenting issues. It's interesting, the more I get to know people like Rachel, I see some really positive things that come out of people who really do spend the time to learn skills like NLP, hypnosis, etc., about seeing more than just a disorder or just a personality issue or all these, looking at the totality of the person and kind of embracing their humanity, which I think always makes therapy go easier. I really enjoy talking to Rachel about specifically her own journey coming from a dance therapy background, which kind of made me chuckle. And she alluded to how you know, now we're always talking about the body, mind, and, you know, all the somatic stuff. And when she started out, wasn't much going on in that realm. So it's kind of nice to hear a lot of these early ideas and techniques that she's been learning now coming more to the surface where people can get great value from them. So without further ado, I hope you enjoy my interview with Dr. Rachel Hott. Dr. Rachel Hott, welcome to Potential Not Pathology.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I'm very happy to have you today, and I always enjoy getting to chat with you. So I think I'd like to start out by having people who might not be familiar with your background kind of fill us in as to what brought you to the field of psychotherapy and psychology. And, you know, you have kind of a unique background, I think.
I think so. I did start a while ago. You know, this would be, let's say, 1978, I guess, you know, in an undergraduate program studying psychology, but then graduating and not really knowing where to take that in the late 70s. But I had always been involved in dance. So when I finally thought, well, I like dance and I like people, and dance therapy was something happening in those times, only in hospital settings, but uh-huh. I followed that thought and did a master's in dance therapy. So that was the beginning, and I would say that was 1980, 81. And during that time, I did start to study NLP. So that really led me into the world of neuro-linguistic programming and Ericksonian hypnosis. And then So let's say that's 1981. And then by 1997, I decided to go back for a PhD in clinical psychology. So, you know, it's definitely been a lifetime pursuit. I think I was just always interested in working with people. Found my way first with dance and then first through neuro-linguistic programming and Ericksonian hypnosis and then back to clinical psychology. So, you know, it's clearly an eclectic history. And, you know, that's where I am right now, just working with clients in that eclectic way, as well as training people in the NLP Center.
And you you operate the center with your husband, don't you?
Yeah, so Stephen Leeds and I, we met at the New York Training Institute for NLP in 1981. And so everything's really way back then. And then we opened our NLP Center of New York in 1986. So we've been operating in Manhattan since 1986 with only a couple of locations, but we've been very strong and steady in Manhattan. And, you know, it's wonderful because we get an international clientele that come from Manhattan. But then, of course, people come from all over the world during the summer for different intensives that we offer.
Right. Well, for some of our listeners who may not be familiar with NLP, could you just briefly kind of mention what that is? Because I think there's a lot of misconception about what NLP is, and those who may have heard of it may only equate it with, you know, personal development programs, which it is, but it's a lot more to it than that.
Well, I'd like to think about NLP as being a communication technology, which is a very broad definition, because then we could think about communication as what's happening between the two of us, right? You know, listening, going back and forth, getting greater meaning, but also the communication within ourselves and how we communicate internally. So that classic intrapersonal and interpersonal communication. And then, like, I'd say any good psychology, you know, we're looking at how to change thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. And so the neuro-linguistic programming model is looking at what's going on in your subjective reality, you know, how you're thinking about things and how you use your language and how you also receive language, you know, both experiences. And then classic programming, you know, just what are those tapes? Nowadays, the language would be, you know, what's your hardware and how to implement a new software. And inside of that, you know, so there's that cognitive behavioral orientation, but then there's this wonderful humanistic orientation inside of NLP that goes hand in hand with Ericksonian hypnosis. So it's a nice blend. I think probably one of the faults of NLP is it's very hard to say what NLP is.
Right.
I know that one thing it's not is rigid or fundamentalist. If anything, it's fundamentalist to not be fundamentalist, you know, just looking at how can we grow and change and learn with these different interesting techniques that, you know, started in the mid-70s, but they keep on developing, you know, people keep on exploring.
Yeah. Now, when you're thinking back over your introduction, what really inspired you to seek real in-depth study of NLP?
You know, I think that it was that funny moment of reading a book, you know, that often does influence people, you know, in terms of self-help books or nonfiction books. And I was reading Frogs into Princes, which was one of the early NLP books. I was attracted to it because of its cover. You know, I really thought it was going to be some Jungian psychology, which was a little bit more of what my orientation was in the early 80s. And then when I actually read what was inside the book, I thought, oh, this is very interesting. I think curiosity led me, you know, you can think about who I was at that time. And, you know, everybody sort of knows, you know, sort of sociologically where you are at a certain time. I was in my mid-20s in the early 80s, It was coming off the heels of the Cultural Revolution in the United States anyway, you know. So I think I was really open to other ways of thinking and the possibility that I could change my thoughts and I could do it with some type of technology per se, for example, decreasing an image or putting a frame around an image. You know, I had never gotten those suggestions before, or identifying what might be the positive intention of some behavior or thought or feeling. These concepts had not been really presented to me in my dance therapy. You know, I think the link might have been awareness of physiology, for sure. I always felt connected to the body.
Right.
So, and that's interesting nowadays because so many people talk about somatic therapy, and I think, oh, yeah, I had that really early on, you know.
Yeah.
But the fascination of possibility and a combination of the techniques, so sort of the technology, but also this very caring, humanistic side of it. So, you know, I may have been 20, 26, 27 searching, you know, I may have really been just looking for what is something that I'm going to be connected to. And it really obviously connected because I've stayed with that for all of these, you know, 30 plus years.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also want to commend you. You and your husband have always done your trainings and things like that with a lot of integrity. And I think that's in kind of a consumer-driven market place that these things have evolved into. You've always, you know, given people a wealth of information in a way that's, I think, congruent to who you are.
And yeah, I think we're doing our best, you know, the classic line about walk your talk, or somehow being grounded, somehow being very real. And, you know, Stephen and I met through NLP, so we were developing a relationship. We became business partners, you know, a married couple, right? Parented children together, and now, you know, dealing more with whatever you call middle age, aging, you know, all these different kinds of seasons of a person's life.
Right.
And so we understand, you know, communication exists in so many different areas. So we're doing our best to live up to that. And, you know, I think many students will say, oh, do you ever get mad? Do you ever get sad? Whatever, you know, and it's like, of course we do, right? You know, but I at least think about resource states. And, you know, the good line from Milton Erickson about everybody has all the resources they need at their developmental time. So I think about my resource when I'm in an angry place or a sad place or an anxious place, whatever. So I usually move out of it. You know, I think more probably I'm in a resilient mode due to my lifetime, you know, studying NLP and psychology in general.
Right. Well, you mentioned, you know, kind of a humanistic bent. I want to ask if you could explain just briefly. I have as you and I have discussed, I have a little background in NLP as well. And I find that the presuppositions that I find in NLP, I think, are wonderful presuppositions for any type of therapy. But there's one that most people will cite, and that is that the map is not the territory.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit about, you know, kind of how you view that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess we can all think about going out to eat, mm-hmm. and you see the menu, and you say, oh, that looks really good, right? And then you get it delivered. You go like, was that really what I wanted? You know, so, you know, the menu is not the meal per se. So the map is a representation. So whatever somebody is sharing, it's still not exactly the territory. So let's say in a relationship, it may be, it's important that we have trust, right? And trust becomes this map.
Mm-hmm.
But what does it really mean? You know, how do we get closer to that? So to not be fooled by what you hear or what you see, you know, to recognize many times we really don't know. You know, we don't really know. So it's typical of an NLP practitioner, master practitioner, trainer, whoever you are in that world, to to ask very specific questions, right? To utilize the language, mm-hmm. to get closer to territory, but to not fool yourself that you would ever really know, because it's just, there's always something deeper, you know, we're trying to get to experience, but will we really? So sometimes it's just recognizing that, not knowing, you know, I'll do my best to understand you. Let me see if I can, you know, the cliche, step into your shoes, you know, see through your eyes, you know, but, yeah, it's all a representation.
Yeah. One of the presuppositions that I see a lot in NLP trainings is one that is familiar to me from Bateson's work about you cannot not communicate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And since NLP is a tool for communication, as you know, well, technically all therapies are, but what specifically for your perspective as a psychologist and a trainer, that you cannot not communicate mean to you?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, there have been many students or clients that will say something like, I can't do anything with this family member or this friend. They just don't communicate, right?
Right.
You know, and they're not communicative. And so it's obvious that whatever the person's doing is a communication. So you can't not communicate. Whatever you're doing is some kind of signaling, is some kind of messaging, and to allow that to be what the message is. So if you're with somebody who doesn't talk very much, that's what their message is. There's, you know, something about their ability to be quiet or their ability to have fewer words, but it is their form of communication. Now, one of the things that I really like about NLP is looking at this idea of communication, because how can, you know, all the years, like when I first started with dance therapy, I thought maybe I would do something like stress management, right? Because, you know, stress exists. And as we know, even in 2016, guess what? Stress still exists, you know? But as I was doing it, I thought, well, wait a second, maybe communication is more important. Because how do you deal with stress, right? You have to know how to communicate with yourself. So in NLP language, I chunked up, you know, I thought communication is a greater category. And that for me is, you know, that no matter what, no matter how advanced we are, that we have the ability to do this interview in this way, you know, mm-hmm. you're in North Carolina, right? I'm in New York City. Mm-hmm. But we still have to communicate.
Yeah.
And there will be times that, you know, I'll see you at a conference and we'll actually have a face-to-face communication. You know, so no matter what, the communication is existing. Mm-hmm. And nowadays, you know, a lot of students will have conversations also about, well, how do you communicate via text? How do you communicate via email? You know, just other ways of communication. But no matter what, we're still communicating.
Right.
So I think that's, you know, my response is, you know, how can you can't not communicate, it's happening.
Right. And that's a common thing I hear with couples. They're presenting problem, if you will. He, she won't communicate, or we don't communicate. And mm-hmm. already it's a flawed frame to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the classic moment to say, okay, so you don't communicate, right? You know, don't agree with them. And then say, and what specifically do you mean by communication or communicate,
right.
or how would you know if you were communicating, or what does communicate mean to you, right? Because then we could get closer to their territory, you know, and discover that, you know, for one person, communication means as soon as you come home, you talk about your day in full detail, right?
Mm-hmm.
Another person says communication is, you know, if I text you, that means I've already contacted you, right? You know, all these ideas of what does it mean, and maybe we'll agree, and then we'll have to come to some kind of, you know, negotiation about, okay, so what do we really want from each other? And all of that is communication, right?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. What are your thoughts on having flexibility in communication, but also just as a therapist and a trainer in general? I guess that's another presupposition from NLP, but just mm-hmm. I notice a lot of people, they tend to adhere to very rigid ways of being in the world. So what are your thoughts on how to become more flexible as a therapist and trainer?
Well, I guess, you know, that there is that, what is that line? If you always do what you've always done, you'll always get what you've always got.
Yes.
So if it's working, you know, you might want to do the same thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if it's not working, then, you know, what haven't you tried? And then you go back to thoughts, feelings, and behavior, you know, and just, you know, like a Bill O'Hanlon book, you just do one thing different. You know, and it can be a small degree of difference, you know, leaving your home and walking out and turning to the right instead of to the left, you know, depending upon if you're a walker, commuter.
Right.
You know, this ability, I don't know who's really said this, you know, where this law of requisite variety comes from.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's something that I know early on in my training, I got this idea that the more flexible you are, the greater you have as a power, let's say, so that you rise to the top, that there's more possibility. And I think, you know, we have to be careful in any kind of way of saying do this and not do that, because then it becomes an either or. So look for flexibility and or not, right? You know, like times when you do. Because I thought over the years, oh, maybe I was too flexible, right? Like what happened to just staying connected to what I think is important. So, you know, these are going to be changing each time you work with a student or a client. But, so you don't want to be too structured, right? What's the Erickson quote? You know, people are too rigid, right?
Right. Yeah.
You know, so, but could we be careful about being too flexible too,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, just something about how do we, you know, I like how Stephen Gilligan will often say, how do you be both at the same time? Or isn't it nice to be both at the same time,
right?
You know, so looking for the balance. These are things I aspire to. You know, do I ever achieve it fully? You know, I'm not into like saying, oh, I am the most balanced person. You know, just working on it.
Yeah. Do you find a lot of times, I mean, to kind of say, you're saying I'm not the most balanced person, but I'm working on it. Do you find a lot of times, particularly when people are taking personal development courses, that there is an illusion on the part of some, not all, but some presenters that, you know, once you master whatever skill, you will suddenly stop being human and happy all the time and all of this? And when people come to one of your trainings and they get all these tools and you're just up front with them and say, oh, yeah, sometimes you are going to be angry. Sometimes you are going to
mm-hmm.
be. How do you mm-hmm. kind of let them know that it's okay that you can actually be happy having human emotions? I mean,
I think some of it may be expectation of where people are coming from. If they've seen some kind of YouTube's, you know, mm-hmm. stories that make it look so magical, right? Or maybe have gone to a Tony Robbins and
they
get so super hyped, and some of that is all great, you know?
Sure.
I think we want people to know that they will have more choice in their life. And then that to me is a greater power than aspiring to think you've attained something that would be, you know, not really attainable, which would be this idea of perfection or never feeling, right, to never feel anger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think all these emotions are useful. So that might be a problem at first when somebody hears it, because they may really be in pain, you know.
Right.
The depressed client or an anxious client, you know, to even present the question of what is that anxiety doing for you, right? I wonder what that anxiety is doing for you. And a lot of times I'll get nothing, you know, it wants to hurt me, wants to kill me. You know, it's not that easy. Sometimes it's more of how to subtly and slowly convince the client and that part of them that's listening,
mm-hmm.
you know, that I really do trust that there's something that this part's been doing for them, or at least initially some time in their life had been doing for them. Maybe it's already overused, you know. So, yeah, you know, it's funny in terms of convincing that sometimes I think my role as a psychologist, which, you know, maybe in the NLP circle, I would say I'm a coach or, you know, but therapist, whatever, is a little bit of like a salesperson in a way of in the best of, you know, to speak to them, to have them start to open up to like, oh, I think I could buy into this idea. Why? Because it's good for me.
Yeah.
It feels better. You know?
Yeah, I think so. And I guess that's also part of the flexibility, as you mentioned, being the best of the salesperson. If we take it out of a therapy realm and just look at an excellent salesperson, he or she has the flexibility to connect with their customer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if we have a client, well, technically they're our customer, they're paying us, and being able to connect with them from multiple perspectives, yeah, it can be kind of a challenge sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do think that, you know, there are people who will come in who have been in other therapy orientations. So although they want something different, which typically will be a highly interactive session with a suggestion from me to perhaps follow a technique idea, you know,
right.
But a lot of people who have already been established in traditional therapy still often want it to remain so, you know, so it's an interesting dilemma at times,
right,
where I know they want something different, yet they're so comfortable and familiar with what they've had in the past. So I have to just, it's all very subtle, gentle, you know, caring. I mean, I feel like I've been influenced by really great people. So, you know, somebody like Robert Dilts and Connie Ray and Steve Andreas and Steve Gilligan. You know, these people have influenced me to be, you know, very caring, gentle, sometimes bold in that, you know, try this out. Come on, you know, you can do it kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I feel really fortunate. You know, I like going to conferences now because it's sort of the only place I'd get some of my experience with these trainers, you know, other than reading books.
Right. Now, you just said something about them being pushing you to become a little more bold. What is your advice for maybe a therapist who might come train with you or whatever, whoever they're training with, and they have some information, some skills that could benefit their client, but yet they're pretty hesitant, either that they just are afraid they won't do it well, or maybe they've got some limiting beliefs about their effectiveness.
Right. Well, I think, you know, it would be still timing with anybody. You know, when do you be more direct and say, you know, let's just go for this. Let's you know, put that concern aside, right? That's pretty bold. I mean, usually I'll do something more linguistic, like, you know, you probably won't like this idea, or, you know, or do the meta program pattern experience, which is, you know, looking at somebody's, let's say somebody has more of an internal frame of reference. So I might say, what do you think would be the better technique to do, this one or that one? You know, sort of offering it that way. But yeah, I think that there are some people who are a little bit more directive. I probably tend to be a little bit more subtle, and I could see that would be, if I have to develop more flexibility, it may be once in a while to just be like, this is the way we're going to do it. Which I think might be more true in a classroom situation than with a client. You know, I do, you know, Steve and I wear a couple of hats, you know, the hat of the therapist, right? The one-on-one or couples or maybe a family.
Right.
Then the hat for training, and that's, you know, NLP classes as well as Ericksonian hypnosis classes. And then the third would be people call us to go into a corporation who are mostly for process communication, you know, sitting with a group and offering them enhanced communication skills. So, you know, I could see where the boldness may be more appropriate in a classroom or in the corporate setting, perhaps.
Right. I think you're probably correct. I also think sometimes a lot of therapists, I know I have in the past, overthink. And, you know, that it comes across with the best of intentions sometimes. Well, I'm supposed to do something this set way because that's how I learned it. And they kind of limit themselves. I remember an old story about Frank Sinatra. It's like he just got off stage and then one of his fans said, "Frank, how did you know to hit that E at that moment?" And he says, "I just opened my mouth and out it came." Sometimes we've got to do that. How do you kind of prepare yourself to be more spontaneous, I guess?
Well, you know, it actually, a recent client, this occurred where we were taking a moment to focus inward, which, you know, was sort of be my preparation for beginning to do some kind of trance work. And as I was exploring, she'd been dealing with a lot of her own feelings of depression and anxiety, and not really so sure if it was going to be kind of creating a resource state or going back in the past for more of healing. I said, "What are you aware of?" And she said, "Well, I see this figure with like an axe, you know." And she was sort of beginning to see this symbol, which, you know, in my moment, I was like, "Gee, I wasn't expecting that." Whoops, you know, she didn't follow the script, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just, you know, knew to stay with it and to explore that and find out, you know, what that meant to her, and to acknowledge that presence, so to speak, was showing up and how we're to communicate. And, you know, but then it was a little bit more in the open space of free for all, like a little bit of improv, you know, holding the space of curiosity, still being curious about positive intention, you know, still being curious about whether there's a story attached to that. You know, she wasn't really aware of it. It was kind of new for her and kind of a new discovery for her. And when I asked her, ultimately, so, you know, like, well, what does it feel like? And she tightened her body and then started to talk about anger. So it kind of moved that way. So, you know, I think that's part of being eclectic, you know, just having your skill set. And then, you know, I remember when I learned EMDR level one, it was kind of more like technique, you know?
Right.
But then when I got to technique level two, it was a lot about, well, if the client says this, or if the patient says this, then do this linguistically or that linguistically. And I thought, that's really just when you're really a seasoned therapist, and you know you have a variety of ways to help somebody, you know, keep on opening the door of exploration or change, or, you know, something that would help them move forward. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think flexibility is about that. It's, you know. Mm-hmm. Anybody who's first new, I think you have to rely on your the things you've been taught, because what else are you going to do?
Right.
You know?
Well, you know, lately I've noticed this, I'm alluded to the therapy marketplace, and I'm noticing a lot of new, new in quotation, techniques I'm reading about that are dealing with things like trauma. And I go and I read it, and then I'm halfway through the article, and I'm like, this is NLP and hypnosis.
Mm-hmm.
So it may be a little frustrating for, you know, when we relabel and rename things, but maybe that's adding a lot of validity to the techniques and skills that you teach and use for people who've gone through, you know, trauma and those kind of things. What do you, when you're working with somebody who has been through traumatic things, do you find that utilizing the NLP, Ericksonian hypnosis is easy? I shouldn't say easy, is a direct route to healing for most of your clients?
Yeah, I think that, you know, first of all, what you're saying is a lot of things get blended in, and maybe people don't give credit to wherever they found their credit. But, you know, I have to say that I have been heavily influenced by NLP, you know, when you think about my early days, right? So in terms of trauma work, this idea of creating a sense of safety, a sense of being in the here and now, I think is really important. And also the ability to learn how to disassociate. So, you know, we talk about the VK, visual kinesthetic disassociation, but sometimes you have to even go further. And so the way that you and I are speaking right now, if we were to observe ourselves, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then even if we were to observe the self that was observing the self, right? So we know that that's working on a whole desensitization piece. So sometimes that's a big practice in itself. There is this group, the Research and Recognition Project, that is working with war veterans to deal with their post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. This is, you know, they're working with this technique, and then, and it goes more into a technical process of once you have those steps of safety and this disassociation where you're observing the self, observing something that you would say is further away. And that's, you know, all these are mental manipulations right now, you know, like on a screen. And then there's this other technical concept of thinking about a beginning, middle, and end of a trauma, you know, and it's never about reliving it. It's about being really in that disassociated state. And again, there's a little bit more technology with that, with keeping it in black and white, allowing yourself to watch it backwards in color and fast, and all those things that takes a while. So sometimes the better thing is just to start with a neutral memory, just to start practicing, because you can see how somebody has to actually be skilled in, as a client, has to be skilled in being able to do that, you know? Yeah. So it's a little bit of rehearsal, but yeah, that's the one I basically use. You know, sometimes it's just a question of, is it too soon? You know, like, is it better just to have the person not have to even look at it from a distance, you know? So that's always a question. When do you deal with this trauma, you know? But yeah, I do work with people in that situation. Unfortunately, the clients that I typically work with are sad stories about, let's say, being in college and dealing with a lot of date rape. But I would say that's sort of more of my population, or maybe a history, unfortunately, of a early childhood sexual molestation.
Right.
Those seem to be, you know, I'm not involved with veterans.
So when you are working with clients these days, find that having that, pretty much everything we've talked about, that flexibility, that attention to outcomes, that, you know, technical expertise, do you find that it's just when you sit down with somebody, you're at the point where it just kind of all falls, I mean, with a good client, it all falls into place where you don't have to think sometimes. It just kind of happens.
No, I think I am thinking. I mean, like, for example, a client came who really wasn't sure if she wanted to stay in her job. You know, she felt very, very good about her job, but it was starting to be more administrative than creative. And, you know, we played around with this idea of parts integration, you know, really looking at the part of her that wants to stay in the job, you know, for security, the part of her that wanted to have more creative, right? But I did think about that because it's a technique I know, you know?
Yeah.
And when she came back several weeks later and she said she'd met somebody, so now she said all of a sudden there's a new element in this conflict. Should she stay in this job or should she go with this individual who she met, right? All of a sudden. And so it sounded again like a parts conflict. And so we did it again, you know. So, yeah, I thought about it. I think that the client who brought up the image, that's where I don't think about it. I had to go with whatever.
Yeah.
But, there are a lot of times I have techniques in my bag, so to speak. And I'll be flexible if, like, the client starts to do, let's say, two parts, and then it ends up being that she's just realizing that she's seeing herself at a certain age. I would shift it then, right? So I know the techniques. I feel comfortable with the techniques.
Right. Yeah. Do you, I know everyone's different, but have you found that the time of actually working with people, there's a certain time where timeline where people get effective at these skills that you teach? Do people, like, after a year, they start to feel more comfortable, or does it just depend on the amount of time they spend in front of people?
Yeah, I like the Malcolm Gladwell concept, you know, about 10,000 hours and yeah. 10 years. But, you know, if you had 10 years, but you only saw one client a year,
yeah.
it didn't work out either, right? So I don't know. I mean, I guess we both could start reminiscing about when we first started seeing clients and mm-hmm. what we were like in those days. And, you know, I think my first experience was getting paid and going and taking the money right away and buying a pair of boots, you know, like just to be so happy that I had gotten paid.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that was a long time ago, right? 1982, probably 83, I started to see clients. So I think it is very, very typical of what we all know, experience, practice, you know, find friends of friends. You know, I do my best not to work with family, so to speak, you know, to understand sort of the classic dual relationships. But, mm-hmm. you know, on occasion, a friend or somebody will ask me for some help. But normally it would be like somebody that you don't know, you know, so you're not mixing up your relationships.
Yeah.
And practice.
Mm-hmm. Well, could you kind of just briefly tell people listening who may be interesting and who may not have had NLP training beforehand, or even those who have had NLP training and may be interested in training with you and your husband, kind of the courses you offer and mm-hmm. kind of those things?
Sure. So we are in New York City, and the center is called the NLP Center of New York. And we offer NLP Level 1, which is a practitioner coach certification. That's 144 hours. Then there's NLP 2, Master Practitioner. It's 128 hours. We offer Ericksonian Hypnosis Level 1, which is 50 hours, and Ericksonian Hypnosis Level 2, which is another 50 hours. I would say those are our main courses. And then there are, you know, occasional two-day courses, something called Core Transformation or Art of Public Speaking, NLP and Sales, or How to Build a Coach Practice.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the compliments that we've gotten over the years is that people feel very safe and respected in the center, and that they also learn both, let's say, consciously and unconsciously.
Right.
That we really do teach with clarity. So we'll do a demonstration. We'll talk about it. We'll talk about what they learned. Then each person gets a chance to practice with a partner or a triad or even a group of five people. Practice both as a coach and a client. And if you're only coming for personal development, we still encourage you to practice as a coach. But, you know, that's sort of what happens. We have very wonderful mixed groups between ages of 18 to 95, you know, just all different ages and interests, and discovering that people are coming really for their curiosity and professional development, personal development. Steve and I take turns teaching. We have a staff that also comes along. You know, we have training assistants. So our group size could be anywhere from six people to about 25. So it's nice and, you know, intimate, I would say.
Yeah.
In terms of New York City being, you know, full of 8 million people, but we create a very intimate space.
Well, I'm happy to hear that, because I've noticed on some trainings, you know, they really pack them in. And I think for what you're teaching, having a reasonable amount of people that you can directly interact with as the trainer, I think is really crucial to people understanding and being able to do what you're showing them.
Yeah, I think that we've been really happy with our system, so to speak, you know, very much about a good ratio of trainee to trainer. And, you know, like I said, we do our best to walk our talk, you know, and to deal with, you know, people have feedback to work on improving. But thus far, you know, it's been a good system to keep it in that moderate size, group size.
Right. And I want to publicly acknowledge that and to also recommend your trainings to anyone listening. Your reputation, I think, is pretty solid in the field. And it's a... I think that's important too. How long has somebody been teaching? You know, what are the feedback? And just from knowing you personally, I have an opinion. But for what I'm hearing from people who have attended your trainings, that's the most important opinion. You know,
it's nice. I mean, it feels really good to have that kind of positive feedback. Mm-hmm. We did write a book. You know, our one book, which is called NLP: A Changing Perspective, which is available on Amazon, would give an individual the experience of what we do in our practitioner coach training. So if there are people who have been listening and are interested in NLP, that could be a good beginning also to check out our book.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as we wrap up, could you tell us the best way people can get in touch with you?
Okay. The best way is our email or our website. So the email is info@nlptraining.com. And our website is nlptraining.com. So that's pretty simple, right? Either way. And we, Stephen and I, basically run the business. So you know that you're going to be communicating with either me or Stephen. Which I think people like also, you know, we've gotten nice feedback that people were surprised at when they called that one of the directors called back.
Right.
You know? So, yeah, it's very personal.
That's great. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time out of your very busy day. And it's always a joy to speak with you. And I, even though we're getting to interact, as we were talking earlier, technologically, I look forward to sitting down face to face again soon.
Yeah, it's been such a pleasure. Paul, you bring so much to the psychology community, you know, all the different communities, and you care. And just by you doing this podcast, you know, you really touch so many people. So I really appreciate your goodness, your big heart.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Potential Not Pathology with Dr. Paul J. Leslie. If you enjoyed the show, check out our website at potentialnotpathology.com, where you will find programs and articles showcasing unique and creative therapeutic applications.